Check, check, check. Let's get the show on the road. Good evening. Welcome to the third installment of Let's Rock and Roll. I'm your host, DJ Trouble, and I can't wait for my classic soul to share some classic rock knowledge with you all every Monday night on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Each week, I will be telling you about a legendary band from the classic rock era. Now we're talking 60s and 70s here. They'll have the baby boomers feeling nostalgic and the newer generations ready to discover something old, yet something brand new. This week, we'll be jamming together to arguably the greatest guitarist to ever exist, Jimi Hendrix. I find Hendrix to be one of the most interesting rock icons out there. He was born Johnny Allen Hendrix on November 27, 1942, in Seattle, Washington, to parents Al and Lucille, who met at a dance in Seattle. He was renamed to James in honor of his father. Al was drafted to fight in World War II, so when Hendrix was born, his father was stationed in Alabama. He wouldn't be able to see his son until he was 3 years old. Jimmy was raised tumultuously, bouncing back and forth between different homes, typically his mother's friends or aunts and uncles, I think even his grandmother. And after 3 years, Al came back, discharged from the military service. The family was reunited after he found Jimi Hendrix staying in Berkeley, and that's where he met his son, and so he took him back to Seattle to be a family. But unfortunately, both parents were alcoholics, which led to violent, intoxicated fights that Jimmy found traumatizing, even hiding in the closet out of fear. Jimmy's family would move around Seattle, staying in cheap motels and apartments, but at age 9, his parents divorced, and the family, which is his mom, dad, Jimmy himself, and 4 other siblings, were split up. Jimmy lived with his father and brother Leon, who Hendrix was close with growing up, and they remained close pretty much for all his life. Hendrix's first instance with the guitar began back in elementary school, when for a year, and this is around second or third grade, for a year he would carry around a broom and use it like a guitar, strum it, play it. Just, it emulated a guitar so much, and he just became obsessed with it. It became so noticeable that his school's social worker noticed the obsession and attempted to convince his school to fund for a musical program for underprivileged kids so that way Jimmy could obtain a guitar, or else she would think he would go psychologically damaged if he didn't have one. The school and the father said no, but I commend the woman for seeing the potential for his amazing musical abilities early on, or just his need for a guitar. However, when he was a teenager, he discovered a ukulele with one string while cleaning an old woman's home. After he received her permission to keep the instrument, he went home and played Elvis Presley songs, notably Hound Dog, with the only note the ukulele can make. A year later, in 1958, he bought his first acoustic guitar for $5 and dedicated all his time to the instrument. He learned by ear while watching others and listening to blues artists like B.B. King and Muddy Waters, which were huge influences of his. Hendrix would go on to create a band, his first band, the Velvet Tones. The band was great and all, but Jimmy's guitar could barely be heard over the rest of the group. And so he's like, well, I need a solution to this. Solution? Buy an electric guitar. This is a common theme with Jimmy. He always needed to be loud and be a showman, which obviously paid off. His father finally caved into the idea of buying his son a guitar and bought Jimmy's first electric guitar in 1959. And the rest is rock and roll history. Now that's the end of the show. Good night. No. Hendrix's first concert was at a Seattle synagogue, where he was actually kicked out by his own band for showing off too much on the guitar between sets. He wouldn't even do the things that he did during his concerts when he became famous. He would just be all flamboyant with the guitar and pretty much stray away from the traditional strumming. So I'd like to think he was too rock and roll back then. They didn't know what was coming. He joined another band called the Rocking Kings, who played at more professional venues in the Seattle area. He wouldn't propel himself to rock and roll stardom quite yet, though, because a few incidents happened in between his teenage years. And by the age of 19, Hendrix had found himself in trouble with the law, being caught riding in stolen cars. So the police gave him two choices: go to prison or go into the army. So in 1961, Jimi Hendrix joins the army in the 101st Airborne Division. So he goes in to be a paratrooper, which is really, really cool. But he hates it. He even begged his father to send him his guitar to basic training to deal with his struggles in the army. Luckily, he did, but it led to some bullying and abuse from his peers, which mainly included hiding the guitar from him and pretty much making fun of him at his own expense because he was different. One serviceman actually appreciated his guitar playing, by the name of Billy Cox, who described Hendrix as a combination of John Lee Hooker and Beethoven, which is interesting. The two bonded and they jammed together, and once Hendrix completed his paratrooper training, he was discharged in 1962 because his superiors felt he was unsuitable for the army. The story Jimmy actually told later was he faked breaking his ankle during a parachute jump just to get out of the army. He would find any excuse to get out. So the year after, in 1963, Billy Cox also gets discharged, and the two get reunited, and they move to Clarksville, Tennessee, and form the King Casuals. Now, I actually had to look up real quick where Clarksville, Tennessee was, and then I thought of the Monkees song Last Train to Clarksville, and then it totally came together for me. Rock and roll usually helps me. But Tennessee is the home to greats in the blues and country genres. That's their main thing, especially Nashville. But so Hendrix made the really wise decision to move to Seattle, or out of Seattle, to get noticed anywhere. Hendrix would go down in history for his theatricality while playing guitar. It was always a show when he performed. So in Clarksville, he began to perfect these guitar antics. He started to learn how to play with his teeth. He saw someone in Seattle do it, and he was afraid of feeling upstage, so he decided to get on their level and play the guitar with his teeth. Eventually, the band moved to Nashville, where a huge rhythm and blues music scene occurred. For 2 years, Hendrix would perform at various venues with his band, as well as a session guitarist for many R&B musicians such as Wilson Pickett and Sam Cooke. Many of these rock and roll stars started out as session guitarists, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, just to name a few. In 1964, Hendrix moved to Harlem, New York, where he met and began dating a girl named Faye, who had connections to Harlem's music scene. Jimmy would seize the opportunities he took here, including winning the year's Apollo Theater Amateur Contest and becoming a guitarist for the backup band of the Isley Brothers. He would play with them for the majority of 1964 on tours, during live TV shows, in sessions, but he left in October to join Little Richard's touring band. Jimmy made his TV debut with this band in July of 1965 on Nashville's Channel 5 Night Train. Eventually, Hendrix and Little Richard would grow to dislike each other. This is always makes me laugh, mostly because Little Richard hated Jimmy's stage antics. Now, this is the same Little Richard who is known for kicking the piano bench out of his seat when he would play, and he would just play as intense as possible. And so he had his own stage antics. Maybe because he wasn't as popular as he was in the 50s, his popularity was really waning in the mid-1960s, mostly because there was a shift in the music scene. Maybe he felt upstaged by Hendrix? That's my theory. Anyway, after playing in a few more rhythm and blues bands, Jimmy decided he had enough, and he felt really stuck playing as a session guitarist. So he ventured on his own to develop his own style of guitar, which would inevitably pay off as he created the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and the world wouldn't know what hit them. After being discovered by a girlfriend of Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards, Jimi Hendrix visited England in September of 1966 and formed a backing band called the Jimi Hendrix Experience, with bassist Noel Redding and drummer Mitch Mitchell, two London-based musicians with experience in jazz and blues. Management tried to pitch the idea of the band as Jimi plus just two other British guys, but they really wanted to make Jimi Hendrix the focal point. He's their bread and butter. But instead, they started to manifest into a three-piece band, being one of the first big power trio bands, doing the most with guitar, bass, and drums. This kind of started in the 60s with three guys just playing as loud as they could on their instruments just to create that high volume effect that sounds very rock and roll. And that's the great thing about this format. Each person can perform as loud and as insane as they want to. You can hear the bass as loud as you want. The guitar, the drums, as long as it just makes listenable music, you're fine. And that's exactly what the experience did. The band began performing in October 1966, and the next month, they played a gig at the Bag O' Nails nightclub in London, such a clever name, with a plethora of rock stars in attendance. Eric Clapton, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Jeff Beck, Pete Townsend, Brian Jones, and Mick Jagger, just to name a few. There were plenty more. Every one of these guys were blown away by Hendrix. Pete Townsend has later quoted, "Jimmy changed the whole sound of electric guitar and turned the rock world upside down." This sort of accolade would shoot Hendrix and experience just to stardom with the release of their 1967 album, Are You Experienced? Following the trend of psychedelia of its counterpart, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was the big album of the year, it broke out as one of the greatest debut albums of all time, and especially one of the best albums in 1967. The album cover itself is really cool. Both of them. If you find this album in the United States, you'll likely find a yellow cover with the band and an album name in trippy purple font with a fisheye lens picture of the band in front of purple trees. It's totally psychedelic, totally trippy. It's pretty much it looks like you're on acid when you're looking at it. However, the cover release in England looks more clean, but it's in black. It's a very dark cover with Jimi Hendrix wearing a long dark cape and raising his arms like Dracula with the rest of the cape kind of drooping over behind the band. And the bandmates are beneath him, which I think is still a marketing ploy, still clinging to the idea of Hendrix being the main selling point. The songs are just as fantastic. Hits like Purple Haze, which you just heard in the intro. Hey Joe, Hendrix's very first single in the UK and in the US. And Foxy Lady. Right now, I will be playing you the title track, Are You Experienced? Not only is this my favorite song on the album, but you'll notice when you hear it, it sounds like you're in a trance, kind of like you're pretty much on acid, but you feel it when you're sober. That's how you know you're listening to good psychedelic music. That's because the song is largely based on a single chord and incorporates backwards guitar and drum parts and a repeating piano chord. You'll listen for the backwards guitar part in, I think, about the 2-minute session. It's in the middle of the song, and it sounds very cool and very Hendrix. So let's enjoy this on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble. You're listening on Penguin Radio.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. But first, are you experienced? Or have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. I know you probably scream and cry that your little world won't let you go. But who in your measly little world are you trying to prove that you're made out of gold and can't be sold? So, are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, Let me prove it to you.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Treble. I was a little disappointed that I couldn't hear the piano chord in that song, but it really made up for the fact that you can definitely hear the backwards drum and guitar, so I'm pretty pleased. But I have to briefly mention this story about Hendrix that will come into play a little bit later. 2 months before the release of Are You Experienced, Hendrix and Kaz Chandler, the band's manager, discussed ways to increase the band's exposure in the media. When Chandler asked journalist Keith Altham for suggestions, he alluded to the Who smashing their instruments on stage, and which Hendrix replied, "Well, it's a pity that I can't smash an elephant." And the journalist would reply, "Well, it's a pity you can't set fire to your guitar." Let's just say Jimi Hendrix had other ideas. Soon after the massive success of the debut album, it stayed near the top consistently for 33 weeks on UK charts. Sgt. Pepper was the only album to place higher on the chart. To pay homage, Hendrix performed a rendition of the title track from that album at the Savile Theatre in London. George Harrison and Paul McCartney were there, and they were impressed and honored. That's the way to do it. Hendrix gained the reputation as an innovative guitarist, using feedback to create different sounds, for example. The experience didn't see much success in the US until the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. Put in as a recommendation from Paul McCartney, now the Beatles were invited to perform at this festival, but they declined as they decided to stop playing live shows the year earlier because of the pandemonium that they would cause. So Hendrix, in a sense, took their place. So in June of 1967, the experience performed at Monterey Pop, and Jimi Hendrix captivated those in audience with his guitar playing and his antics, notably setting his guitar on fire at the end of the set. I told you that story from earlier would be important. Rolling Stone magazine captured the image of Hendrix setting his guitar on fire as he's kneeling in front of the fire, raising his hands. From then on, Hendrix would become a legend in the United States. I'm going to play the opening song for you that he played at Monterey Pop, a rendition of Howlin' Wolf's Killin' Floor. You're going to be listening to this on Penguin Radio. We'll be right back. After that song and that impressive performance at Monterey Pop, management wanted to immediately gain publicity for Hendrix, including booking the experience as an opening act for the Monkees. Now, this is pretty funny because the Monkees were a teeny bop band. Although they were considered part of the British invasion, they definitely catered to more of the preteens rather than the rebellious rock and rollers. The Monkees themselves were fans of Hendrix, their fan base not so much. They would think, oh, it's too loud, and he's not even cute. Davy Jones is just so cute. Ew. So they left after six shows and started to make their second album, Axis Bold as Love. This album still looks psychedelic, but the songs are primarily on the hard rock side, with deeper lyrics about science fiction and outer space, something Hendrix was fascinated by. The album was released in December of 1967, reaching number 5 in the UK and number 3 in the United States. I'll be playing a classic off this album, Little Wing. This song is described as a feminine ideal with its angel-like lyrics and slow, soft tempo. You'll enjoy this little song on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu.
Yeah. blast you with another Bosco break and your weekly update of Dominican soccer. Coming at you with another Bosco break and your weekly update of Dominican soccer. Dominican University of California's Lily Dubuque has been named this week's PacWest Women's Soccer Freshman of the Week. The award is based on games played September 28th through October 4th. Dubuque registered her first career goals, scoring in each of Dominican's two wins. She notched the game winner in a 1-0 win over Holy Names and scored the first goal in a 2-1 triumph over Dixie State. She took 6 shots in 2 games after recording 8 shots in her first 7. The Penguins now share first place in the Pac West at 3-1 and will hit the road for the next 5 matches. Dominican will head to Fresno Pacific, Notre Dame, and then embark on a 3-match trip to Hawaii. Good luck and good job, ladies. Keep it up. That was your weekly Bosco break, and you're listening to radio.dominican.edu. Tell me who I am.
Welcome back, rock and rollers. You're listening to Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu. I hope you're enjoying this hour all about Jimi Hendrix. I know I am. The release of Axis, Bold as Love, was the first sight of Jimmy's perfectionism of the recording of songs and the way he wanted them to sound. This would cause tension between Hendrix and the manager, Chas Chandler. The tension just got worse as the band recorded their third and final album, Electric Ladyland. I consider this an album not from the experience, but more of a solo effort on Jimmy's part. You could definitely tell that this is his album rather than the band's album. That whole manifestation of them coming together as three? No, it's definitely him. So during the sessions, Hendrix would fill the room with his friends and other guests while recording. He really just became in charge of the whole thing. It only made the manager more angry, and he would eventually quit managing the band after the release of the album. But back to the album. Electric Ladyland features a rendition of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, which is arguably Hendrix's most well-known song. Other tidbits about this album. The 15-minute song Voodoo Chile featured Jefferson Airplane bassist Jack Cassidy and Traffic's Steve Winwood, who played the organ on the track. The song Burning of the Midnight Lamp was the first to ever incorporate the use of a wah-wah pedal on the guitar, forcing the guitar to create that onomatopoeia sound in the device. But the song I'm going to be playing for you is my favorite of the album, 1983, A Merman I Should Turn to Be. Now, I describe this as psychedelic genius. Heavily underrated in Hendrix's career, we're going to bring this obscure song to life. But not all of it. After all, it's 13 minutes. But here's 1983, A Merman I Should Turn to Be on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on Penguin Radio.
To take our last walk through the noise to the sea, not to die but to be reborn, away from a land so battered and torn. Such a mess, every inch of her is a fighting mess. Giant pencil and lipstick tube shaped flames continue to rain and cause screaming pain and the arctic stains from silver blue to bloody red as our feet find the sand and the sea. Is straight ahead. Straight ahead.
it's too bad that our friends can't be with us today. Well, it's too bad. The machine that we built would never save us. That's what they say. That's why they coming with us today. And they also said it's impossible for a man to live and breathe underwater. Forever was a main complaint. And they also threw this in my face. They said, anyway, you know good and well, it would be beyond the will of God and the grace of the king. Grace of the king.
Now we pause for station identification. This is Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. Currently, you are listening to Let's Rock and Roll, and I'm your host, DJ Treble. This hour, we've been listening and talking all about the great Jimi Hendrix, and we're going to enter the year of 1969. Now, 1969 was the year of the breakup of the Experience, which really began after tours in Scandinavia, Germany, France, and their final European shows in London. Noel Redding grew tired of Hendrix's creative Iron Fist control of the band. Their final performance as the original Experience occurred at the Denver Pop Festival in June of 1969. The day after, Redding quit the band to attempt a solo career. Well, I never saw one out of him. I saw one out of Hendrix, though. Hey! Hendrix then moved to nearby Woodstock in upstate New York in the summer of 1969, and he would go on to headline the infamous Woodstock Music Festival that same year. Now, the famous story of Woodstock goes, a man named Max Yarsker rents out his farm in White Lake, New York, in preparation for the festival. Nothing like this had ever happened, and Woodstock became historic, the epitome of the hippie counterculture, but it also became a huge nuisance for anyone who wasn't part of the hippie counterculture. My dad even attended Woodstock, and he was 13, a little California boy hitching a ride to upstate New York to attend Woodstock, also known as the three of the greatest days of many people's lives. Yeah, my family's hardcore rock and roll. But 32 acts appeared at the festival, including The Who, Jefferson Airplane, and of course, Jimi Hendrix. He was financially the biggest thing in rock and roll, so why wouldn't you have him be the main spectacle? Although the festival over the span of 3 days peaked attendance of 400,000 people, and Hendrix was the primary draw to the festival, only about 30,000 people stayed to the end to watch Hendrix perform. Of course, the festival went on from Friday to Sunday, but many people don't know that it actually went into Monday morning, and this is when Jimi Hendrix performed. At 8 a.m., bright and early. His performance at Woodstock is best remembered with his rendition of the national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner. And you bet I'm playing that for you right now. You're listening to the Star Spangled Banner on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. We'll be right back. welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Trouble. Now, I just want to talk about Woodstock for a little bit because Jimi Hendrix's performance at Woodstock just absolutely stole the show, even though hardly anyone was there. He was dressed up for the part two in full red, white, and blue fringe, and he put the peace sign at the end, just, you know, speak to the hippies and all. But the funny thing is about that recorded performance, filmmakers actually came to Woodstock only by word of mouth, which is how most of the people got in anyway. In fact, after a while, the people in charge of Woodstock would actually stop charging people because there's just too many, so it became a free concert. The filmmakers actually filmed the entire thing of Woodstock, the whole concert, and and when they pieced it together and they saw the phenomenon it became, it won the 1970 Academy Award for Best Documentary. So, I think that's pretty cool. But, after his epic performance at Woodstock, Hendrix released the only live album while he was alive, Band of Gypsies. The Band of Gypsies, which made their debut at Woodstock, were an all-black trio of Hendrix, his old friend Billy Cox, and drummer Buddy Miles. Hendrix had received criticism for not using his heritage as an example for Black Power movement of the 60s, as he would never publicly speak up for civil rights. Not that he didn't support it, he just never made the statement with his words, he just made the statement with his music. So speculation is that he created this band to please the critics. Hendrix always seemed the type to not find political statements necessary, but rather create music to contribute to. Band of Gypsies was released on March 25th, 1970, recording the band's New Year's Day performance at Fillmore East in New York City. The most notable track off the album is Machine Gun, which is a 12-minute piece that Hendrix created on the guitar to sound like rockets, bombs, and diving planes. The closest Hendrix ever got to a song alluding to the Vietnam War, or any political statement for that matter. The Band of Gypsies only performed three times together, their final performance at Madison Square Garden for the Winter Festival for Peace. But how that band disbanded is the same way the Experience disbanded. Jimi Hendrix wanted too much control, and he ended up getting in a bunch of verbal disputes with his manager, and the band disbanded, and Jimi Hendrix was like, I want to do my own thing. I'm Jimi Hendrix. And so he did. So he began creating material for what would be his next album, The Cry of Love. He had begun the project in 1968, but ditched it midway to go on tours. That project, again, was halted in July of 1970 to perform at various venues and festivals, including his largest American audience ever at the Atlanta International Pop Festival on the 4th of July, drawing in 500,000 people. Now, Jimi Hendrix has a notorious dislike for playing in front of very large crowds, so I don't quite know how he got the courage to perform, but I think he just kind of remembered his obsession with the guitar and just did his thing. So his final U.S. concert was on August 1st, 1970, in Honolulu, Hawaii. After, Hendrix and his new bands, which is kind of a mix of the old Something Borrowed, Something Blue, not really, but old friends Billy Cox from The War Days and Mitch Mitchell from The Experience. Now, Hendrix and Redding had their bad falling out, and Redding actually thought The Experience would get back together. But instead, he was like, no, I hired my friend. He's better than you. And so they became the band then. And it's kind of like a Jimi Hendrix Experience 2.0. So they left for England to head to the Isle of Wight Festival. And Hendrix would never return to the States. Billy Cox would, and he would quit this band because he had a neurotic breakdown while on LSD. So he returned to his home state of Pennsylvania to try to get better. So he began his Cry of Love tour in Europe in September of 1970 with his final concert in Germany. His final public appearance was at a jazz club in Soho with Eric Burdon of The Animals and his new band War on September 16, 1970. Now this one was kind of interesting because he wasn't his usual Jimi Hendrix, play the guitar as crazily as possible. He just looked like his session guitarist days where he would just sit there subdued and just play the track. It was a very different Jimi Hendrix, and you could tell something was wrong. But Jimi Hendrix actually died 2 days later after that concert on September 18th, 1970, in his hotel room in London. But before we get into all that, I will play you a song off his posthumous album, Cry of Love. This is called Angel, and I find it 100% appropriate for this instance to play. You're listening to Angel on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on Penguin Radio.
Angel came down from heaven yesterday. She stayed with me just long enough to rescue me. And she told me a story yesterday about the sweet love between the moon and the deep blue sea. And then she spread her wings high over me. She said she's gonna come back tomorrow. And I said, fly on, my sweet angel. Fly on through the sky. Just a child's sunrise. And my angel, she said unto me, today is the day for you to rise. Take my hand, you're gonna be my man, you're gonna rise. And then she took me high.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. This is your host, DJ Treble. Now we're wrapping things up here on the third installment of the show tonight, and we're paying an hour-long tribute to the legendary Jimi Hendrix. Now, I like to think of that song, Angel, was really appropriate for that last album because to many people, Jimi Hendrix was an angel to the rock and roll scene. It was kind of like he was sent from above or something to really change the game and pave the way for many rock musicians to come and just entertain us with his creativity. He really is a really nice angel to all of us. But as I mentioned, Hendrix died on September 18th, 1970. His cause of death was asphyxia, or choking on his own vomit while under the influence of barbiturates, a type of depressant. Hendrix had been addicted to drugs and alcohol since his Clarksville days after being discharged from the Army. Like I mentioned earlier, his mother and father were also addicted to alcohol, so alcoholism is definitely in a family history. But, however, when under the influence of alcohol, friends and those around him would cite violent and erratic behavior from Hendrix, very similar to what his parents would demonstrate. Hendrix's first known use of LSD was at Monterey Pop in 1967. This was a turning point in Hendrix's drug use. Beforehand, he would occasionally smoke marijuana or just try drugs recreationally just to try them, but never actually get hooked on them. But right after Monterey Pop and right after he got famous in the United States is when he really started to involve himself in the drug culture, in the drug scene. So afterward, he thrust himself regularly smoking cannabis and using LSD and amphetamines while on tour, just to really trip his mind, because he also said that he felt like people never understood him, or he can never explain the way he thought when it came to his songs, especially lyrically and musically. So his use of LSD kind of justified that, saying, well, anyone on LSD automatically expands their mind when they're on acid, especially acid or LSD, so people will understand my music more. So he was never really in his raging or violent moods when he was on drugs, but he would be when he consumed alcohol or mixed the two together, which would end him up in legal trouble, such as an incident where he got busted by Canadian police for his possession of drugs, and he was eventually discharged from that. But he would also be involved in intense and violent fights with girlfriends that sometimes led to physical abuse. His vice of drugs and alcohol caused his young death at the age of 27, becoming one of the multiple members of the 27 Club. This is really intriguing for rock and roll history, because 27 seems to be the curse age in rock and roll, which is, people say it's a coincidence, but others will say it's just an actual curse. It's valid. It's real. You gotta watch out for your 27th birthday, especially if you're on the path of using drugs and alcohol and living recklessly, because you will end your life quickly. So the people who were cursed to pay this ultimate price to pay for their gluttonous lifestyle were Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, Brian Jones, and most recently Amy Winehouse, all make up the 27 Club. But back to the music. Hendrix's album Cry of Love was released posthumously in 1971. 12 more albums would be released after his death. And these were just studio albums. This doesn't include live albums. The first live album to be released after his death was Live from Woodstock, and then eventually Monterey, and his final concert with the Experience live in Denver. So what people would do is they would collect all of the Hendrix recordings, because he had a lot of them left, especially after his death, that he just never used or never put into his albums. So eventually a bunch of compilation albums would be released, and Hendrix is still topping the charts with his music even after he's dead, so legends never really die. So the latest one that was released being People, Hell, and Angels in 2013, which, for example, composes of unreleased songs that were intended to appear on Electric Ladyland. Like unused sessions, songs that he really wanted on the album initially but never got on, things like that. Jimi Hendrix will go down as one of the greatest guitar players of all time. My personal opinion, the best guitar player to ever live. He changed the game. He was instrumental in the exploration of the electric guitar, taking the instrument to limits musicians had never dreamed of before. He was the first to really use distortion and wah-wah pedals to his advantage and enhance his guitar mastery. There will never be another Jimi Hendrix. Hell, maybe there won't be anyone else close to Jimi Hendrix. Maybe. But don't forget to check out all of our other DJs at radio.dominican.edu. For my shout out tonight, it's another music show, but this time showing some love to the local artists here in the lovely Bay Area. much like I'm sure Jimi Hendrix had some local support in his hometown of Seattle. Check out Bay Area Beats, music from around the Bay with DJ Keeks, on Mondays from 1 to 2 p.m., only on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. Here you'll discover some new artists around here. Or, who knows, one could be the next best band or the hottest new artist. Maybe even the next Jimi Hendrix. Doubt it. You gotta be pretty good to be Jimi Hendrix. I hope you enjoyed this hour about him tonight. This is DJ Trouble, signing off with a song to ease yourself into the final hours of the day with The Wind Cries Mary. This is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu, the official station of Dominican University of California. Go Penguins!
After all the jacks are in the boxes, and the clowns have all gone to bed, you can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers merrily. A broom is drearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping. Somewhere a king has no wife. And the wind, it cries very.
And the wind cries, Mary.